if we trust that Christ, ultimately God, is going to bring about ultimate redemption, then that frees us from the impossible burden of figuring it out ourselves. It gives us the opportunity, the gift, the invitation, I guess, to participate in that redemption now. So we have the opportunity to do good work because it's good, because it participates in the good, because it's serving the good. The healthy response to an overconfidence in our own abilities is to recognize the givenness of all life.
Jeffrey Bilbrow is Associate Professor of English at Grove City College, Editor-in-Chief at Front Porch Republic, and the author of several books, including one we discussed today, titled Virtues of Renewal, Wendell Berry's Sustainable Forms, published in 2019. Jeff discusses how Berry's thinking stands in stark contrast to many of the norms and habits of modern society, and how greater mindfulness of some key virtues may help us find moral, spiritual, and social renewal. I'm Matthew Wickman, founding director of the BYU Humanities Center. Jeff, thank you. It's a privilege to talk with you today on the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me on today, Matt.
I know this is a busy week and month for you. You're moving across the country to begin your new job at Grove City College. And just a couple days ago, you had a brand new book come out titled Reading the Times, A Literary and Theological Inquiry into the News. Now, I've not read that book yet, though I will soon. I've been reading the older news, I guess, in the form of your 2019 book, Virtues of Renewal, which we'll discuss in a couple of minutes. First, though, I like asking guests how they imagine their faith in the context of their life and work. In your case, I might ask you whether these books, you know, Reading the Times and Virtues of Renewal, are expressions of your faith. If so, how?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think in my case, certainly the answer is yes. But how, I suppose, is the more nuanced or tricky part. I guess maybe the short answer is that I went to Bible school right out of high school and spent a year in England. And one of the things that struck me during that time in a sort of international Christian context was some of the idiosyncrasies of the American Christian environment I had grown up in. And it was very enriching for me to be introduced to international Christian communities and the deep wells of the Christian tradition that I, you know, knew about some, but hadn't really thought through or experienced personally. So I think in a lot of my academic work and also my teaching, I try to introduce students and readers to this sort of this broader, deeper Christian tradition than we sometimes think from and experience, I guess, in our day-to-day American lives. So yeah, trying to share the gifts that others have shared with me.
Okay. Those gifts in that tradition are so rich, and I find that they act on me continually to, you know, read these things, engage them, and think about them, and find that they change my own perspective on things. Do you find the same thing? So does your relationship between your faith and your work keep evolving over time? Or have you found the sweet spot, Jeff, for your finished product?
Of course not. No, absolutely. I mean, I think it's hard to draw a bright line between, say, my devotional life and my academic research. You know, oftentimes the books that I'm reading, the scholarship that I'm reading, the theology that I'm reading, the novels or poetry I'm reading inform and shape and challenge my own practice of faith. So I think that's maybe one of the great joys of being a professor or a writer is having that back and forth between the intellectual work and, you know, trying to be a good husband and father and teacher and person.
Yeah, great. So I've got to ask you, we're going to talk about Virtues of Renewal in a minute, but I've got to ask you first just a question or so about your brand new book, Reading the Times. That's a good title, but that subtitle, A Literary and Theological Inquiry into the News, is provocative. So I've got to ask, what is literary and theological about the news?
Yeah, I guess a lot of the content behind the subtitle comes from the sources that I draw on. So there's a lot of books written about the news right now. It's kind of a hot topic, I guess. But what I'm trying to do, just because of my own background and interests is to draw on a longer theological and literary tradition of thinking and responding to the news. So sometimes we tend to think that the digital era is brand new and the news and all its attendant opportunities and challenges are new and unprecedented. But, you know, humans have always been interested in the news, and there's been new media technologies several times in the past that have been quite disruptive and have presented these new opportunities and challenges. So I try to, you know, draw on this longer tradition going back, I guess, primarily to 19th century America and the people responding to the change in print technology then, but certainly further back too, to people like Blaise Pascal or Augustine. So I think, you know, maybe kind of putting aside the particular technocratic challenges of our moment and thinking about the broader issues like what's the news for? What is the news? As I pose in the introduction, what do we need to know to love our neighbor well? And maybe thinking about the news from that perspective can help us sort through the more particular questions from a better posture.
That's a great question. What do we need to know to love our neighbor well? I think that doesn't occur to enough of us neighbors, you know, in the way that we imagine social life these days. And your point about the past not being quite as distant from us as we imagine is, I think, is right on. I remember years ago reading kind of a fun article. I think it was Alan Liu at UC Santa Barbara wrote this piece called Friending the Past. It was about kind of these ancient, like, oral dynamics, oral literature dynamics, and how those created in their own moment a kind of a network that we now have kind of reimagined in terms of social media and things like Facebook. But his point was that, you know, the past acts on us in ways, or, you know, manifests itself anew in ways that would be surprising to us if we understood what the past actually was. That book, I look forward to getting and reading. It sounds great.
Well, thanks. I'll have to look up that essay. That does sound like a similar angle. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You'd enjoy that, I think. And he may have done some more with that than just the essay by now, but I've got to check up on that. He's a great thinker, Alan Liu. Let's turn to this book of yours, 2019, not so old, okay, just 2 years after, Virtues of Renewal, subtitled Wendell Berry's Sustainable Forms. The book appears in the Culture of the Land series, published by the University of Kentucky Press. In your book, again, it's about Wendell Berry. Berry sits on the series advisory board. And I'm curious, you know, is this the book that you set out to write, or did the book that you imagine writing change on you as you were writing it? So the book that appeared in print, is this the one that you wanted to write?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, as you know from your own writing experience, you never fully, and you know, writing's a process and it's a learning process. And so you envision it one way. And then as you begin the work of writing, it grows and becomes more particular. But in general, I think that I had a pretty clear sense of what I wanted to do from the outset, just from my reading of Berry. And once I kind of got the framework in mind, the writing process was mostly fleshing that out. When I first came to Spring Arbor University, where I'm leaving, been here for 9 years, one of my colleagues in the English department here was also a fan of Wendell Berry's, and right away talked about writing a book together. And I proposed, well, we talked about two ideas. One was kind of something related to this, Virtues of Renewal. And the other was something about Berry and higher ed. And so Jack and I wrote the Berry and higher ed book together. But then I kept playing with this initial idea and then afterwards developed it into Virtues of Renewal. And both those books came out with Cultures of the Land, which is a great series that Norm Wirzba kind of heads up at the press. I think I hope it's not defunct, but it's kind of slowed down in recent years. But it's a rich series, and there's a lot of good titles in the series.
Yeah, that's right. You know, Norm was a guest at BYU a few years ago and was talking a bit about all these issues, including some books in the series. And I thought to myself then, yeah, that sounds really good. And your book, certainly very, very high quality. You know, the book channels a lot of your own. It seems to me it is a book about Wendell Berry, but it's also a book kind of about Jeff Bilbro. You know, to what extent is Berry a kind of a surrogate of yours in the book? Or I guess conversely, to what extent have you modeled your ideas on Berry's?
Oh, it's such an astute question, but I don't know how to answer it. You know, okay. It's kind of impossible to say because after you spend so much time reading and thinking and kind of inhabiting the voice of somebody, even when you disagree with them, your thoughts are shaped in response to theirs, right? You know, Berry, my last chapter in this book is called Convocation, and I talk about the kind of dynamic whereby our identity, even our, the words we think with the categories in which we have to think, our desires, what we want, are shaped in response to the voices that we are in dialogue with. And Barry has certainly been one of those prominent voices for me. He's not the only one. There's a lot of other ones, some of whom I found because they were cited in Barry. But yeah, I think, you know, there are a few points where I might disagree with Barry here and there or emphasize things differently. But I must say that he, when I first started reading him, I had a lot more disagreements. And for the most part, he has persuaded me and changed the categories within which I think. So
That's interesting.
It is a book about Barry, but it's certainly also a, you know, a book where I, it's not a disinterested objective analysis of Barry, right? It's me saying, this is an important voice. He's taught me a lot. And here are how I think his ideas might apply to us.
See, that's one of the things I most appreciate about the book. It really is the book's a portrait of a mind in motion. You know, yours as it evolves, also as it thinks in, I think, very energetic ways about a number of modern issues that Barry addresses, but that you're also addressing by way of Barry's work. It's a book with, I think, very high moral stakes. And I admire that about it and frequently moved in reading it for that reason. The subtitle here, right, Wendell Berry's Sustainable Forms. In a few places in the book, you inquire into the moral and intellectual work that literature can do to help us create these forms, right, to help us create better communities. I'm curious if you could distill for us a bit how literature accomplishes this work, how literature creates these sustainable forms.
Yeah, and as you know, I mean, you've written about this. It's such a fraught question. Maybe I'll deflect this one back to you after I relate my stab. Because I always want to kind of come down on both sides of the fence. On the one hand, I mean, I guess in the book, I frame this in terms of Auden's poem for W.B. Yeats, where he says, poetry makes nothing happen, right? There's, literature is not a technology that can make us into moral people or can create healthy communities. But it is, Auden says in that poem, it's a way of happening, right? It's a way of being. And perhaps by inhabiting that way of being, we can be shaped. Certainly from in my own experience, the books I've read, the novels I've attended to, the poems that have become part of the mental furniture of my mind, they have reoriented the way that I relate to my real life communities, certainly in many ways. And I've seen this happen in my students too. So literature does have, can have a transformative effect, but it's not a guarantee, right? It's not like you plug in this poem and out comes a moral person. So I don't know. I tried to kind of walk both sides of that line and not overpromise while also not underpromising, you know, not selling literature short. And I think part of my attempts in that introduction especially also flow from the sense that our culture tends to devalue the humanities more broadly and literature in particular. There's this focus on, you know, STEM education, which is good and necessary, but it was also me trying to defend, I guess, the continued importance of literature and the other humanities for their formative effects on us as people. But I don't know, does that make sense to you? What do you think? I mean, how do you articulate that tension that's always present, I think, in these conversations?
Yeah, first of all, you are preaching to the choir in what you say there, you know, and I thoroughly agree. I mean, again, not to discount STEM, that's very important for all kinds of obvious reasons, but not to over-exaggerate its importance either, right? Or at least not to exaggerate its importance at the expense of the humanities. For me, you know, what you say really rings true. There are two ways I often think about my reading in literature or my reading in philosophy or whatever, right? On the one hand, you can look at literature or philosophy as bodies of ideas, big troves of wisdom, you know, a ready quote to pull out, you know, there's more in heaven and earth, Horatio, than is dreamt of in your philosophy or something like that, right? You know, but on the other hand, for me, what's most important about it is not so much the trove of quotations or other people's wisdom, but rather the energy of engagement, right? That you have to really get in there and really learn how to think through ideas and think through language and sentences and meaning and process of formation. And as that happens, I find that for me and for my students, it's kind of a refining effect. Something happens to change how I think going forward, having been through the experience of learning how to engage language and ideas at that depth and with that degree of energy. And that alone for me is what makes literature a discipline that tends towards sustainable forms, as you put it. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, I like your term energy of engagement. engagement and maybe also, you know, a kind of mode or shape of engagement, right? It's when you read a poem or a novel, you pick up a certain habit of mind or a certain posture that then you might take with you and apply in ways that the author wouldn't have imagined, right? But it's given you another way of being in the world. And I think that's what makes it so potential anyway, transformative.
Yeah, agreed. Thank you. One of the recurring ideas in the book is that we can practice resurrection. This is a term of Barry's, right? It's a provocative term. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, it comes from the last line of maybe his most famous poem, Manifesto, Mad Farmer Liberation Front. And it's kind of a striking term. I actually wanted it to be the title of my book.
Oh.
But then somebody else stole it the year before mine came out. So we had to go back to the drawing board. And the press was great and helped me come up with a new title. But yeah, it's a key idea. And it's kind of weird, right? How do you practice resurrection? The way I understand Barry using this, it's kind of, you know, how do we live now in light of our hope for a future resurrection? So kind of a 1 Corinthians 15 response, I suppose. And this, you know, plays out in lots of different ways. I mean, I try to explore different facets of it in different parts of the book, but maybe at its most essential, I think practicing resurrection for Barry means that we have to change the way that we relate to death. So that death is no longer only an enemy. It's still an enemy, still bad, but it's also the portal to new life. So we can't simply avoid death at all costs. And part of what I try to lay out, especially in the beginning of the book, is that our industrial culture, Barry thinks, and I tend to agree with him, in some ways is set up to help us just avoid death. And some of its most unhealthy features come from its fear of and sort of animosity toward death. So what might it look like if we changed our relation to death and tried to hold it in place so that it could serve life. It could be the portal to resurrection. And, you know, I try to explain that in ecological terms, but also psychological and communal and, you know, the different levels to this. But yeah, I guess at its core, how do we live now in light of a future resurrection?
It's such an important point. You know, my wife is a therapist, and for a while she was a social worker in a hospice company. You know, so she was working with patients who were dying, their families and grieving. And she's got, a very enlightened view toward this very use your phrase, industrial culture. And, you know, not just her, but religious communities generally tend to be more open about the reality of death. And I think that the way you sort of spin that idea, not spin it, but maybe run it, thread it through your chapters is very well done. And you do create a very compelling portrait of a different kind of culture, a different way of being in the world. And you have the chapters are built around these different virtues. There are, I guess, seven virtues you discuss that all work harmoniously. And that last chapter on convocation, as you point out, that's kind of the chapter that says, it shows how they all kind of work together. You mentioned, though, that you might have discussed other virtues than the ones that you actually do. So you go over attention, gratitude, humility, hope, memory, fidelity, and convocation. So one obvious question would be, why these particular virtues when there really are so many others that might also be here?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of obvious ones that I neglected to talk about, right? I guess there's sort of two answers to that, maybe. One is that I thought those were particularly central to Barry's kind of contrarian or unique approach, you know, ones that were more unusual to an American mindset. It's also, you know, the other organizing feature of the book, I guess, flows from my question, which is, why does Barry write in these different genres, right? Most authors kind of choose one and they write novels or they write poetry or they write essays, and Barry does all of these things. And so I tried to tease out how different genres might help him explore particular virtues in each in their own way. So I guess that's kind of the two main questions I had in mind as I thought about which ones to include. But yeah, there's so many others I could have included, right? I don't include any of the four cardinal virtues, for instance. So I think there's definitely room for more chapters.
That's right. Volume 2. I can already see it, right? Well, the ones that you do choose, though, they really do have this really lovely, kind of harmonious relation with each other. I mean, you do a really good job, Jeff, I think, bringing these together. Maybe we could talk about a couple of these. I could point to a couple passages in your book and have you elaborate or either explain or elaborate as you see fit. Maybe one I could point to is on gratitude. And you spend time in this chapter elaborating on competing views of life, right? One is of autonomous selves that seek to make their way in the world the best they can, kind of going it alone. The other is of selves that are embedded in communities. And these latter communal selves understand life as a gift, right? Whereas these autonomous selves address life as a matter of exchange almost, right? I get what I want, you get what you want, and we'll negotiate that arrangement together. Could you, I mean, what connected, you know, that kind of idea to a virtue like gratitude?
Yeah, I think, you know, as a farmer, Barry is well aware of the limits of human volition, right? You can have all these grand dreams for what you want to accomplish, and they can quickly come to naught or quickly be overturned by the weather or a recalcitrant animal or whatever. You know, there's just only so much you can control. And so I think his poetry and his other writings, but his poetry in particular, is such a great antidote to our kind of technocratic efforts to make all of life predictable and plannable and within our control. We can choose and we can, you know, attain the desires and the plans that we have. So I think the healthy response to an overconfidence in our own abilities is to recognize the givenness of all life, even when that's not necessarily what we would want, right? Even when difficult things come as a result of that. But to recognize that at root, life is a gift, and our first response should be gratitude, even when it's very difficult. So kind of a posture of you know, gratitude for the givenness of life. And I think that is very foundational to Barry's vision, for sure, but also to a life well lived and the possibility of genuine community with others rather than simply treating other people as means to get what we want.
It's such an important idea. There's a passage in that chapter about Christ that seems to me to have broad application. I'm going to ask you about that too. You invoke the prayer that Christ offers in the Garden of Gethsemane prior to the crucifixion, right? The Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as thou wilt. This is from Matthew 26. Then you remark, and I'm quoting here, that prayer enacts the difficult acceptance of an undesired gift. And you elaborate below that we sometimes do not recognize redemptive love when it appears because we demand that it come according to our expectations. Right. In essence, what you're saying is that we seek redemptive love as a matter of exchange, you know, these good deeds for that good outcome, rather than as something we are given and which we necessarily adjust, even when it comes as we may not have desired it.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, in that chapter, I'm mostly talking about Barry's poetry, but I suppose my attraction or my zeroing in on Christ's prayer in Gethsemane is also due to Barry's use of that scene in his novel, Jaber Crow, where that becomes, well, it's the reason why Jaber stops praying in his youth, because he thinks, what's the point of prayer if Christ's own prayers are in some ways not answered? And, you know, if prayer if I can't pray something and get what I want, what's the point of prayer? and then in his maturity, I guess, Jaber takes up prayer there again and says, not my will, but yours be done. And in some ways that is kind of the foundational prayer, right? It's the core of the Lord's prayer. And then it's at this crucial moment in Christ's life. And it's not easy. It's not necessarily pleasant because sometimes the gifts of life are not what we would choose. But I think that posture of gratitude again is foundational to any other moral act that we hope to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that's important about it that really struck me was that it showed that, you know, kind of these habits of kind of transactional thinking, even imagining ourselves, you know, as on the consumer model, you know, that we exist to acquire pleasures or acquire experiences, you know, and there's a cost for the acquisition of the experience that we want. And it shows that kind of thinking can also enter into otherwise sacred spaces, you know, religious communities, even personal spiritual lives, and that there's a discipline to learning how to acquire the virtues you're talking about, that Barry's talking about, ultimately that one finds in Scripture. And this is not a discipline for the faint of heart.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, gratitude is not easy, especially when it's most important to practice. So it's something that you have to, you know, that's why resurrection is something you have to practice for. We have to take up that work of moral formation so that in the difficult times, we're able to be grateful even when it's not the natural response.
That's right. Another chapter all these chapters, Jeff, they're great. Maybe I could ask you about the chapter on hope. You know, you discuss the problem with big technological solutions to our problems. For example, you know, carbon capture for bringing down CO2 levels, right? And you say that this causes us, on the one hand, to depend wholly on technology to solve our problems. But on the other hand, then it makes us feel powerless in the day-to-day. I mean, what's the point of my recycling, being mindful about how I use or consume energy if I don't make a difference? I'm such a small footprint on the planet. And you contrast that technological hope, which renders us powerless, with what you call eschatological hope. I wonder if you could comment on that difference.
Yeah, I think, you know, Barry is such a trip for some people on this subject because he doesn't really fit the categories. I mean, on the one hand, he has, you know, I am thinking of the speech that he just gave, the commencement, the graduation of the students in the Barry Farming Program. And the opening 10 minutes were, you guys are all graduating into an ecological and agricultural crisis of epic proportions, and it's bad out there. You know, I mean, read the Unsung of America. He's been saying this for decades, right? It's just very bad, and it's getting worse. And then the second part of the speech was advice for being happy. You know, and I think that's kind of jarring. In Manifesto, the Matter Farmer Liberation Front, there's one line that just reads, expect the end of the world, laugh. and that juxtaposition, you know, I think is so crucial, but such a hard balance, or maybe it's not a balance, maybe it's a tension to maintain. And I think that the key, if there is a key, is to have an eschatological hope, right? So, yeah, I guess the idea basically is that we do hope for the redemption of all things, and we hope that all that is broken will be made right. But we don't hope that because we're going to get sustainable, renewable energy figured out that's perfect and allows us to use whatever energy we want and it's free, you know? We don't hope because Elon Musk is going to come up with some brilliant technology. It's going to be really hard work, and it might be painful and not fun in the interim. But if we trust that that Christ, ultimately God, is going to bring about ultimate redemption, then that frees us from the impossible burden of figuring it out ourselves. And it gives us the opportunity, the gift, the invitation, I guess, to participate in that redemption now. So we have the opportunity to do good work because it's good, because it participates in the good, because it's serving the good, even if that our actions, right? Even if recycling or growing a garden or, you know, cooking our own meals or whatever the case may be, even if that is not going to solve the agricultural or the climate or any of these other ecological crises.
It's such an important insight of yours and Barry's. I was struck when I read this chapter in your book, and that's a chapter you adapted. It's in Comment Magazine, the recent issue of Comment, and it's a great article and a great issue there in Comment. And of course, this chapter of yours I found really compelling. What strikes me about the importance of this eschatological hope, as you articulated, is that it's about us becoming, in some ways, better people. And if there are going to be large-scale solutions to our problems, it can't just be, it's going to be sort of technology that occurs amid our decadence. It's going to require that we be the kinds of people who then are able to sustain the kinds of communities, the kind of world that we can perhaps help to heal, you know, with God's help, that we need to be different or better. It's not just that our tools become more sophisticated. That's right.
Yeah,
I mean,
because otherwise we'll just be able to use our more sophisticated tools to inflict more damage on the earth and one another. So, you know, just getting a more powerful computers and more powerful technology is not a recipe for health and social harmony.
That's exactly right. You write about virtues of renewal, how they operate, you know, in tandem with each other, a kind of an ecology of virtues, you know, one upon the other. While these virtues do operate symbiotically, you know, is there one virtue in your view that seems perhaps the most urgent one for us to think about at the present time? Like if someone asked you to write another article and comment and say, you know, choose one virtue, Jeff, from which we can begin thinking about the others. Is that an impossible question, or is there one where you'd say, you know, you might start here?
Yeah, I mean, I think I already mentioned this, but in some ways, convocation and the practice of convocation, I think, is kind of the apex, maybe. So it's not necessarily the starting point, right? But it might be the culmination or the ending point. And I think it's also one that is so crucial to our individualistic kind of therapeutic culture. And Barry, you know, Barry's whole emphasis on membership, which he of course gets from St. Paul and the metaphor of the church as the body of Christ, his whole emphasis on membership flows from his conviction, I guess, that we belong to one another. And we have to figure out how to belong well. I think maybe it's an unsettling of America. He has a great paragraph where he says, he concludes something to the effect that, you know, no one is actually independent. We just have to choose between responsible and irresponsible interdependence. And convocation, I guess, kind of names is the term that I pick up from his writings that I think points toward how to live well as members of each other. And it certainly depends upon all these other virtues as well, and even the ones that I don't focus on.
Yeah, and that chapter is really great. You point out there that convocation really does also involve accommodating voices very different from our own, right? You talk there about some of the racial crises that we face, and about how, you know, convocation really, it's a discipline that one learns not just to hear oneself echoed, you know, in others right close to one, but really learning how to exist in deep simpatico, you know, with those who are very different from ourselves.
Yeah. And it's not, you know, it's never going to be neatly resolved into a univocal single voice, right? We have to learn to live in dialogue, and that's uncomfortable and difficult. And yeah, I talk briefly about Barry's and others thinking in these terms about race and the way that sometimes, you know, certain races or certain voices can get silenced or forgotten. So it's certainly, there's all kinds of ways that convocation can go wrong. But I think that the good that it names is something that we have to keep striving for nonetheless.
You know, I was reading the essay published in Comment, and I know that you've done a lot of these podcast interviews, both about this book and about the new book that's brand new out, Reading the Times. And I was when I read the Comment, I'd read articles you'd published before and thought, that's really great. That's a smart piece. So when I read you in Comment, I thought he'd be great on the podcast. That was what sparked for me the invitation for you to come on and talk. Put me in mind of how a few years ago, someone who I assume was one of your mentors, Alan Jacobs, wrote an article in Harper's about the declining place of the Christian public intellectual. I'm curious, you know, do you see yourself playing that kind of role, or at least seeking to emulate the virtues of the public intellectual?
Well, that's a very generous question.
Well,
and you're right, Jacobs has certainly been an influence. Well, maybe the first piece that I published, one of the first pieces I published outside of academic scholarly forums was actually a response to Jacobs, because he was criticizing an element of Wendell Berry thinking, and I was pushing back a bit, but he was very gracious and we had a good exchange. But I've certainly learned much from Jacobs over the years. And part of that essay, you know, is that the reason that we don't have public Christian intellectuals anymore is that the kind of cultural landscape has changed and that there's not that space anymore. So I think that's an issue, that the ecosystem of ideas has changed. But I also think I know my own limits pretty well. And I'm not ever going to, you know, write a brilliant field-defining book or idea or essay or something. And that's fine. I think the way I've come to see my vocation, I suppose, as a scholar, is somewhat akin to the way I also see my vocation as a teacher, which is, you know, maybe I'm called to be a gardener who kind of weeds out the bad ideas, you know, clears out the confusing or distracting noise. And I hope then that gives space for the good voices, the ones we need to attend to flourish. And then I hope to point readers or students toward that good fruit. So, you know, that's part of the reason too why I've taken up the editorial role at Front Porch Republic, because I think that the practice of editing and shaping a kind of public conversation is one way to work that gardening role, I guess, and try to create an ecosystem for good conversation and good intellectual community to develop. Because in our current public discourse, I think those spaces are pretty rare and often quite diseased in various ways. It's hard to have the kind of intellectual dialogue that we need.
I really, first of all, I admire your modesty, and I also really love that image of the gardener. I had a kind of a, not that image, but something similar a few years ago as I was debating whether to stay at a place I was working in Scotland, a research university, or come back to BYU to direct the Humanities Center. And it struck me that they were different kinds of roles and that maybe I was better suited to the one than the other because it would allow me to work with more people. Instead of kind of going out there and blazing my own, instead of playing the part of the athlete and trying to score 70 points in a playoff game or something like this, you know, by writing the field defining book. Maybe it'd be better if I worked more as a coach, you know, to help other people's work or to help allow games to happen. I don't want to get too elaborate with the analogy, but something I really do admire about your work a lot is that it seems really not to content itself with tribal thinking. I mean, you really work through issues in a subtle, very principled way. I mean, so you write about environmental causes, which is often a feature you hear on the left, but you also embrace Christianity, which tends to be more associated with the right. Again, those break down. But the point is, you know, you really do cross boundaries quite gracefully. Is that a line that you self-consciously walk? And I guess the deeper question there is, can one be a tribal thinker and still be a devoted Christian? Or does following Christ require us to leave tribal thinking behind?
Yeah, that's such a tough question. And I think maybe to answer the first part first, I think I mostly follow Barry in kind of not fitting into, I guess, the boxes of our contemporary, at least political tribes. You know, Barry is one of the few people, I think, a few voices today who is admired by people on the left and the right, although he's also criticized by people on both sides for different reasons. But he really is respected, even though he is not comfortable on the kind of U.S. political map. But I think he's right to upend the map and to try to chart a more sane path forward. And I also think, I mean, you're right that so much tribal thinking can be really unhealthy. On the other hand, and I guess one place to get this that I've benefited from is Alan Jacobs' book, How to Think, where he talks about this some. But on the other hand, humans are inevitably tribal thinkers, right? We need to think in community and with others, and we depend upon that kind of social technology, social environment to think well. So instead of trying to think, I don't know, independently or as a maverick or something, I think it's been more helpful for me anyway to find a tribe that loves the right things, that models a rigorous pursuit of the truth, that offers opportunities for healthy membership. And then that's maybe one way that it's easier to navigate the unhealthy tribes that oftentimes get more airtime, I guess, in our public discourse. So that's, you know, and I guess maybe one more thing is back to what I said earlier about convocation, you know, the body of Christ in some sense is a tribe, but it's a tribe that cuts across all of the ways that human tribes are organized. So I think Christians have a call to practice community and practice membership in ways that are always going to run counter to more standard or other ways of belonging to each other.
Yeah, that really resonates with me. I would make a distinction between tribalism as we commonly think of it, right? And what you describe as convocation. Because convocation, again, it demands that we grapple in dialogue with real difference of opinion, you know, not just the difference that is familiar to us and that we've kind of pre-digested. And even, I think, you know, in dialogue with God, which means that one's always in conversation with the self that one is not yet. Not that God is oneself, but, you know, if God is working toward, you know, our disciplined acquisition of virtues, you know, then we are not yet the beings we are capable of being, which means that, you know, we are having to sort of grapple with what we are becoming. And in that respect, you know, we're not finished. We are in community with ourselves as well as with God and with others. I'll leave you with this question here, right? So you observe culture broadly. I'll ask you this. What gives you the greatest hope in the present? You know, because it is such a tricky age. Back to Barry's, you know, convocation speech, you know, well, things were dire, go be happy. So, you know, okay, got it, right? What gives you greatest hope that that's possible in the present?
Yeah, I, in that hope chapter, and then also in the comment essay, I conclude with Barry's reading of Shakespeare's King Lear. And one of the things that Barry points to about that play, which is, of course, a tragedy, right? It's not a comedy, is that we see the possibility of moral conversion, that even the people we thought were beyond the pale and irredeemable can be converted. And maybe this is one, just one kind of example of this. I was reading Paul Kingsnorth's essay in First Things maybe a month or so ago. I think it's called The Machine, the Cross or something. And he has a remarkable life story. He's also the editor of a collection of Barry's essays in the UK. So he's a Barry appreciator as well. But he was not a Christian until I think last year. He's tried all kinds of things. And this essay is just a remarkable conversion story showing, you know, kind of articulating how Christianity was the last thing that he wanted to affirm for all kinds of reasons. And he found himself becoming baptized in spite of himself. And, you know, reading a story like that gave me great hope, you know, that all the sort of sociological trend lines or the economic trend lines, the technological trend lines, they're not written in stone. And we don't know what might happen. And the givenness of life means that sometimes life surprises us. And so there's always room and opportunity and even the obligation to hope.
That's a great note on which to conclude. Jeff, this has been such a pleasure talking with you. Thank you for your excellent work. And it's really a joy to read what you're writing. And I look forward to seeing you again soon sometime, whether at a conference or out this way at BYU.
Well, likewise, this was a very generous, thoughtful interview. So thank you for your time putting this together and blessings on your work there.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University and is produced and edited by Brooke Brown and Abby Thatcher. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.